This is the Behave Yourself Podcast, a podcast about behavioral science in the Global South, brought to you by the Busara Center for Behavioral Economics. I'm your host, Linda Kimaru. Bilal Siddiqui and Anna Yaluris are two people who know a thing or two about medical responses in a health crisis. Both have had experience conducting research about Ebola in Sierra Leone during the 2014 outbreak, and this has offered interesting insights into what the world's response to COVID-19 has been. Bilal Siddiqui is a friend of Busara based at Berkeley's Center for Effective Global Action, and Anna Yaluris is an engagement director at Busara who focuses on health. In this episode, interviewed by Ruth Kanagaraja, one of our senior associates, they discuss the nature of comparisons and if and how we can apply lessons learned from the 2014 Ebola outbreak to the global response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Welcome to episode 4 of Behave Yourself, Unintended Consequences, and Lessons Learned from Past Pandemics.
To kick off, I'd first really like to chat to both of you about Ebola, given that both of you have done research around it and the unintended consequences and domino effects in tackling that virus. So Ebola has offered these really interesting insights for this continent, and it's frequently drawn upon when we're discussing recent health emergencies in sub-Saharan Africa. What has been your experience with the context of Ebola? So Anna, in the same way that coronavirus has set our expectations for managing the present and not really knowing the impacts in the future, what were some unintended consequences and domino effects from Ebola?
So I think there's two big impacts of pandemics. One is on society and the other is on health systems, and both kind of interplay with each other. So on the one hand, we have the fear or lack of trust in health systems. You know, there's that drop in routine vaccination coverage, and there was also a drop in coverage for other preventative and non-acute care like prenatal care, and a spike in teenage childbearing. And I think this is actually really understandable and something we're seeing in a lot of other countries for the COVID pandemic. With schools closed, children out of school need to be occupied, and the oversight that teachers play is not always replicable by parents. So why this is a big deal, pregnant girls are not permitted to attend school in a lot of countries, and rates of returning to school after pregnancy are very low. So while girls and boys both participate equally in the activities that result in accidental pregnancies, the consequences are disproportionately falling on the girls. Overall, closing schools has a lot of consequences beyond what's felt in the immediate period of closure, because a lot of children, both the boys and girls, will never return to school just because the continuity is broken. We know there's a really strong link between mother's education and the health outcomes of her child. So in a scenario where girls have increased likelihood of childbearing, this impacts their own education prospects as well as the long-term health outcomes for their child.
Thanks, Anna. And maybe now, Bilal, rerouting it to your work, there's this saying that progress moves at the speed of trust, that the factors and the practices that form trust are required for any complex endeavor. Can you share the role of trust in improving health outcomes from your research in West?
Sure. So I think this is it's really interesting because when we started thinking about improving health outcomes in Sierra Leone in particular, we also started thinking very much from an incentives framework that essentially the problem in Sierra Leone, as in many other countries with weak health systems, is that nurses and health professionals, such as they are, don't really have the right incentives to work. We thought about incentives in a couple of ways. At the time, there'd been a couple of really big studies that had been circulating for a while. There was a study by Tina Bjorkman and Jakob Svensson that had looked at the importance of community monitoring, which was really an intervention around improving the relationship between the communities and the nurses. And as I've probably already given away, kind of central to that improvement in relationship was trust. But as economists, we didn't think about this as a trust-improving intervention at all. The intervention itself, called community monitoring, really was bringing communities and nurses together in a room and getting them to talk about healthcare, talk about the problems with healthcare within their communities, and making a series of agreements and commitments to improve healthcare, to do that for the nurse to do that through turning up to work, being nicer to their patients, informing the communities more, helping make sure that the medication and so on was available to them and so on. And for the communities to do that by being nice to the nurse and by taking the antibiotics for the full length, for the full amount of time they're supposed to be taking them, washing their hands after they eat or before they eat, etc. Our role in all of this was to run surveys. The government, in the meanwhile, hired three NGOs, that's Concern Worldwide, Plan International, and the International Rescue Committee. When the disease was first discovered and first spread, there were so many just crazy theories about what it was. It was seen, there was a lot of stigma around what it was. There were just fears that people had, just as there are fears with COVID now. And to overcome those fears, basically, you need to trust. And what we find in our study is a lot of evidence that essentially what these interventions did was improve trust between the communities and their clinics. That trust came because people started perceiving these improvements in the quality of healthcare. So by using the clinics more, by getting being more satisfied with the way their healthcare was offered to them. And as a result, when Ebola came around, they said, hey, I'm feeling sick. I think the nurse is nice. I'm going to go and report to the nurse.
Yeah, and I would really agree with what Bilal's saying. I think particularly in a pandemic setting, the perception of trust or confidence in the health system is particularly important because individuals do face this choice about whether to cooperate with response efforts. You know, do they honor the quarantine? Do they wear the face mask? Do they report to the center for testing? And, you know, I think like with the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, COVID has also been surrounded by rumors and misinformation. And these rumors and this misinformation is really toxic to response effort. So communities really need accurate information about how to contain the disease, but they also need to trust that information. So, you know, thinking creatively about how to build that trust, how to build that reliability. And I think you need to address trust issues both on the supply side and on the demand for services to effectively contain the disease. And, you know, I think something that was really successful for finally containing the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone was bringing in community leaders and religious leaders. So in times of crisis, these are the people that the population turns to. And if you can make them the champions of your kind of critical health messages, it's really hard to prevent rumors from spreading, but we can identify reliable sources and give them the right information to spread to their communities. And that's one lesson that I think was really acutely learned in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa that we can take some learnings from for the COVID pandemic.
It's time for a quick break and your behavioral science term of the week. In today's episode, you've heard the guests, Anna and Bilal, talk about incentives. But what exactly does that mean? So simply put, an incentive is something that motivates a person to take a certain action, and you can think of this in two ways, extrinsic and intrinsic incentives. Extrinsic incentives involve providing a material reward, like money, and there is usually the threat of a punishment when you don't complete a task. Intrinsic motivations don't have this outside pressure or reward, but instead, the value is placed on the satisfaction of doing something just to do it, like learning a new skill. And that's your behavioral science term of the week. Welcome back to episode 4 of the Behave Yourself podcast. I'm your host, Linda Kimaru. Now, here is the second part of Ruth, Anna, and Bilal's conversation, where they're talking about how we can apply lessons learned from the 2014 Ebola outbreak to the global response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, I think this is a good segue into the nature of comparisons now that we're starting to kind of jointly talk about Ebola and COVID and where it relates and where it might not. So there are many comparisons that have been emerging of pandemics, whether it's the influenza of 1918, SARS, Ebola. There's this renewed interest of plagues and epidemics, both from recent history as well as bygone eras. And it's obvious why. There's this very human need to seek foresight in a context where everyone's just kind of rushing headlong into the unknown. I think this creates a need for us to reflect about comparisons. What do we risk conflating or simplifying when we're comparing these different beasts of crises? People are seeking a playbook by considering history as prologue, but are we misleading ourselves in harmful ways?
Yeah, I think here I want to focus on a couple of the similarities, because I think there are differences in pandemics, you know, the way the disease is spread, who it affects, how it is spread. But there are also a lot of similarities that I think do offer lessons throughout history. And the similarity here really relates to the capacity of health systems to deliver services during a crisis. So that is like the capacity that a health system can attend to everyday health needs, you know, your broken bones, your accidents, your childbirth, prevention activities that are aimed at long-term health while also responding to a pandemic. And I think with the COVID crisis, we've really seen how even well-functioning healthcare systems can be overwhelmed by an unexpected crisis, you know, such as we've seen in Italy or the USA. In Sierra Leone, the national health system was already supported by NGOs and civil society organizations that did public health work in the country, as well as these traditional healers. And during the crisis, when the crisis hit, many health orgs that previously did activities like vaccine promotion or reproductive health pivoted their focus and pivoted their operations to focus on the pandemic. Now, I think this might have played a very important role in curbing Ebola transmission or treatment-seeking behavior, but it also left a gap in other health services like family planning and vaccination. And I keep mentioning family planning and vaccination because these have massive consequences for long-term health and well-being of a country. And, you know, as we saw with Ebola, and I think we can expect with COVID, pandemics last a long time. And so you need to be ensuring the continuity of routine services while also responding to pandemics, because one feeds into the other. You know, if citizens lose trust in clinics' ability to deliver vaccines, will they be willing to visit clinics for Ebola or COVID testing? An unreliable supply of care erodes trust in all aspects of care. So preventing or containing a pandemic may also mean keeping these services that populations use very consistent and reliable. And, you know, like Bilal was alluding to, making the quality of care something that patients want to return to, that they makes them feel good about, you know, their own health and their prospects for getting more healthy or feeling better.
So what I find really interesting is that so in the US, the number of deaths for COVID that reported to be due to COVID are about 160,000. But the number of deaths that are in excess of what we would expect them to be is about 220,000, which means there's about 60,000 deaths that are not reported due to COVID, but that are greater than what you would have seen a year ago, even if you take out the 160,000 deaths due to COVID, which means there are 60,000 people who have died in the United States that we can't explain. And I'm wondering, based off of, for example, what Anna says, so one way to think about this is that these are deaths that people who had COVID but were never, let's say, tested, had kind of symptoms that didn't seem COVID-related, et cetera. But another way to think about it is these are people who would have had normal healthcare were the health systems not completely overburdened, right? Or people who would have normal palliative or other kinds of care, were healthcare workers not completely taken over? Were the economy not completely falling apart? So there are all of these additional deaths and morbidities and that come from having a pandemic hit you that we don't think of when we think about the cost of the pandemic necessarily, because they're not recorded as pandemic related deaths, but they are actually caused by the pandemic. And I'm actually curious, Anna, to your knowledge, like, how do we think about Ebola mortality when we think about it in Sierra Leone?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and you know, relates a lot to what I was discussing earlier, that you know, the impacts really span beyond just those who will die of the disease to, you know, secondary impacts, people who will die of long-term diseases or won't get the care they need. And, you know, as I mentioned, there were measles outbreaks in West Africa following the pandemic. I don't have figures for the mortality there, but I think, you know, in a context like West Africa, where mortality reporting is already quite shaky, you know, a lot of the numbers have kind of focused on what is a confirmed case, just because so many deaths from other causes will go unreported. Ebola deaths were more closely guarded, at least at the end, by communities and better reported because they needed safe burial procedures. And once those were finally taken up, then we got quite accurate data on a number of cases. But no, there is this whole hidden cost that I think relates to, you know, the impacts to the education system, early childbearing, which is more likely to result in deaths of either the mother or the child. And these are often not considered, you know, and I think it's maybe a very natural response of healthcare systems that are already overtaxed to respond to a pandemic by letting go of everything that is not an essential pandemic response service. And I think that's really where the crux of this, you know, this comparison comes from. Like, we want to take our knowledge of the Ebola pandemic and use it now, like in this moment, to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes for the globe, for the whole world, in equipping our hospitals, our healthcare centers to continue responding to everyday needs and long-term health needs, as well as responding to the pandemic. And one other thought that comes to mind here, something else that you know, we have in common with Ebola and COVID, these are both zoonotic diseases, meaning that an animal disease jumped into the human population by close contact. So, you know, really we shouldn't think about this as a coincidence, but rather a product of population growth and humans ever encroaching into wild lands, which creates a lot more opportunities for humans to have close contact with wild animals and catch their diseases. So from this perspective, I want to propose that we should consider zoonotic pandemics a feature of our public health landscape in the future.
Yeah, I really like that idea of kind of seeing these growing trends and also what is kind of undergirding or kind of pushing forward these pandemics. That's a really interesting insight, I think. But kind of going back to the nature of comparisons, Bilal, I think perhaps the more difficult question is, how do we know when and where to apply these comparisons?
I generally think that the issue around trust, for example, is very widely applicable. I think that that is exactly when you decide to go to the clinic. It depends in a lot, or report to report your health status, to get tested. That depends a lot on how much you trust the healthcare system. Trust is clearly not enough, right? At the same time, in the US, for example, COVID has become completely politicized, and whether or not you wear a mask is now dependent not on how much you trust the healthcare system, but how much you trust the government, right? Whether or not you engage in safe behavior, quite apart from any economic constraints that you might have, you can't constantly stay locked down maybe, but whether or not you engage in safe behavior depends a lot upon, also about whether you believe what your politicians are saying versus whether you trust what the nurse or doctor is saying. And there's a weird interplay over there. So every pandemic, every disease outbreak, I think will come with its very specific set of sociological and political characteristics. I don't know, and I think Anna, you must have a much better sense of this, but I don't really know how that played out in Sierra Leone, unfortunately, but I worry that taking like that one lesson of trust is not going to be sufficient. I also think it was COVID and Ebola are also, despite both being zoonotic, despite both being rapidly spreading and all of that, they have these very different characteristics, right? So Ebola, one of the kind of the quote unquote good things about Ebola when you think about its spread is that it spreads, it has a really high mortality rate. So the chance that you will die if you get it in a short time is very high. As a result, it also doesn't have the ability to spread that far. So after a point, it works too well. It kind of works against itself, right? It kills off the hosts at a pretty fast rate. Whereas COVID and for Ebola also, symptoms set, like the onset of symptoms happens faster. The infection happens while you are symptomatic, and deaths happen sooner. With COVID, as we found, a huge population is asymptomatic. The onset of symptoms happens days, if not more than a week after, often after you've got the infection. And a lot of the population, the death rates aren't so high, so a lot of the population is able to recover or to be alive and transmitting for a longer period. This makes it much harder to deal with, because with Ebola, yes, there have been multiple resurgences in West Africa and elsewhere, but there is a sense that the disease is over, right? And with COVID, it is not that clear. And so with Ebola, you can say, in principle, let's buckle down. This is a national emergency, an international emergency, whatever. And with a lot of loss and of lives and a lot of tragedy, we still see an end to this. It essentially what we're saying is, if the country is functioning and there's trust in your government and there's trust in your systems of communication and information, then things are good. And I also worry that I think it overlaps a lot with your access to technology. It overlaps a lot with, you know, social media related disinformation that can spread so quickly. There's a lot going on that makes a lot of these difficult these difficulties in informing and responding to a pandemic really out of the control of anyone who's starting to try and think about how to do it.
You know, it's interesting you were saying, Bilal, about the shorter and kind of more rapid onset of Ebola and kind of more rapid progression to either cured state or death. You know, there's a lot of cultures that do have touching in some capacity as a very kind of sacred and important moment. And, you know, containing a disease that, you know, is invisible but comes across on your hand or, you know, some other avenue of touching really, really requires more than just messaging. You know, you have to actually change the culture and give people safe and reasonable alternatives that will help them feel so good about how they kind of live their lives in the world while also being you know, more safe and not engaging in practices that do spread the disease. So, you know, here at Pusara, when the pandemic started, one of our first activities was creating a new handshake, a no-touch handshake, you know, which is, again, just a small element of culture, but in, you know, the business world, a handshake is an important kind of signal and starts the meeting. It's very hard to avoid it. It feels kind of awkward to start a meeting without that handshake, but it takes, you know, rethinking ways that we can create those moments of meaning and retain some aspect of some of the important aspects of culture while not while changing them enough that they don't become vectors of transmission. Health systems that are already working in partnership with civil society or, you know, local health organizations really need to work together. You know, if the need is on boosting response efforts, then, you know, that's where the need is. But, you know, not letting those routine aspects of care or those long-term preventative methods fall to the side if we do pause those services in favor of the pandemic, you're going to see deaths compensating in another area of health. So I think really, you know, building resilience with healthcare systems to be able to do all at once, which is no easy task and requires a lot of planning and preparedness. And, you know, I liked a lot what you said earlier, Bilal, about, you know, Sierra Leone's ability to respond to COVID is so much greater now that they've gone through the experience of a pandemic. And I think, you know, that's something that, you know, maybe for better or for worse, we can start counting on in the future. If we experience, you know, as many epidemiologists believe, more and more zoonotic outbreaks in the future, you know, due to our population growth, then this experience of having a pandemic, living through a pandemic, and containing it will be a critical part of what populations need to kind of learn the lessons of time and in how to prevent the spread of infectious disease.
And that's it for episode 4. Huge thanks to Bilal and Anna for the insights today. If you would like to learn more about the Ebola study Bilal mentioned, there is a link in the show notes. Next week, we begin a 3-part series on misinformation. Over the next 3 episodes, we will explore what our research told us about misinformation, fact-checking in the Global South, and how this ties back to customer engagement. So subscribe so you can get alerts when that goes live. Behave Yourself is a production of the Busara Center for Behavioral Economics. Find us on Twitter at Busara Center and read about the work that we do on our Busara blog on Medium. Until next time, remember, behave yourself.